10463 Sierra State v. Lawrence Williams and 010464 State v. Antoine Matthews. Arguing for the state is Assistant Attorney General Stephen W. Kleinmeier. Mr. Kleinmeier?
May it please the court, my name is Stephen Kleinmeier, appearing for the state, the plaintiff appellant petitioner. The issue in this case concerns whether Lawrence Williams was seized at the time he consented to the search of his car. It's the state's theory that the traffic stop had concluded when the documents, the driver's license and the registration and the rental agreement were returned to Mr. Williams. He was given the warning ticket that he signed. The officer shook his hand and said, now you can be on your way. Mr. Williams wished the officer, okay, have a good day. Mr. Williams then turned and started walking to his car. The officer turned away and then turned back and started asking the questions and said, hey, Lawrence, do you have any guns or drugs or guns in your car? And the questions pursued, continued. Now, it's the state's theory that the traffic stop, the detention, had ended by the time the questions started, and that the questions came during a consensual encounter. The significance of that is that for consensual to ask questions at that point, the officer did not need reasonable suspicion or probable cause to ask the questions.
So what were his, Mr. Williams, choices at the time the officer shook his hand, turned around, and then asked, what choice did he have? I mean,
he could have continued onto the car and just left. The trial judge asked the officer, said, what would have happened if Mr. Williams had done that, had left? And the officer said, I would have had to let him go because I didn't have any reason to stop him.
And you think that's what would have happened? That's what he said would have happened? That
the officer would have
started
let him go.
Asking the questions and the person just walks off. This was at what time, 2:30 in the morning?
Approximately then, yes. Yes, it could happen. There are also cases where we've cited some in our brief. The person doesn't necessarily just drive off, but the officer starts asking questions, and the person, you know, asks whether he has to respond, and the officer asks for his consent, and the person says, "Well, do I have to give consent?" I mean, the person, not all drivers, just automatically answer the questions and automatically give consent. Some of them refuse. There's two cases from Wisconsin. We cited the Beto case and the Gammons case, where when the officer asked for consent, the driver said no. They wanted to continue on.
Mr. Kleinmeier, what's a badger stop?
Well, first of all, the officer explained that's a drug interdiction stop, where they are going to ask for consent. I think that the reference to that in this case by the defendants is totally irrelevant, because what's important in here is not the motive of the police officer. The subjective intent of the officer is just irrelevant in a Fourth Amendment case. In this situation, so whether it's a seizure, and that's what the objective test, whether a reasonable, innocent person would think they were free to leave. So what's going on in the officer's mind is irrelevant unless it's communicated to the other person.
So even though the officer indicated when he testified in court that it was his intention to enter into a badger stop, that makes no difference because we're to apply an objective test. Is that your position?
Correct, yes. The test for the seizure, which we've just been getting into, here is what the reasonable innocent person would believe, whether they would believe they're free to leave. And also, the mere fact that the police officer asks questions does not constitute a seizure. And the mere fact that the U.S. Supreme Court and this court has recognized that just because a citizen is normally inclined to answer questions posed by a police officer, that itself does not make a seizure. What you need for a seizure is some conduct by the police officer that makes the person feel they're not free to leave or that they're required to comply with the officer's request. What's cited by that for examples of that kind of conduct in the Mendenhall case in the U.S. Supreme Court and many cases since then, examples are the presence of more than one officer, the display of a weapon, physical touching by the officer, or using a commanding tone of voice or indicating compliance is compelled.
Well, it almost seems as if the conduct of the police officer was quite premeditated. In fact, maybe they teach it at the police academy. And it was designed to put the defendant at ease, to believe that this whole very difficult encounter was all over with, and thereby inducing the person who is stopped to feel, a sigh of relief, and therefore possibly make him more amenable to consenting to a search. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but isn't that really what's probably happened here?
Actually, that's what Mr. Matthews says should happen. His argument is that the police officer is supposed to communicate, get the message across to the person that they are free to leave. So in doing this, by telling the person he returned the documents, telling him he's free to leave, letting him start to a car, that communicates to the person, or the person can then know that they are free to leave. So
did
I think that complies.
Did he start his car here?
No, I'm sorry, to the car. He took a couple steps walking to the car. He didn't reach the driver's seat. So I think that, yes, I think that when the officer, gets the message across to the person that they're free to leave, that's their duty. They're doing what, maybe even more than they have to. There are some of these cases.
Like the pizza delivery, right? I mean, the officer's hoping that they're going to respond in the way that he did here. But if he doesn't, he's gone.
That's right. He can get in the car and leave. And telling
now, what do you think would happen if the guy said, look, I'm free to leave. We're done with this ticket. I'm not answering your questions. Is that reasonable suspicion?
No, at that point, the officer said, the trial court asked almost that identical question, and the officer said, I would have let him go because I had no reasonable suspicion to keep him. And the officer, and there are a couple cases that I mentioned before where officers have not let the person go, and they found out they can't, that they did it wrong. The Beto and Gammons cases, the person refused to give consent, and the officer made them wait, I think, in each case until a drug dog showed up to sniff, and the evidence was suppressed because they made them wait when they refused consent and wanted to leave.
What you want to come out of this case is that you have every right not to answer any questions unrelated to the traffic stop?
Well, I think this court's already said that in Griffith, if not before. I mean, the person can refuse. There's nothing. I don't know that anything ever compels a person to answer a police officer's question.
Mr. Kleinmeier, if you think that this is a consensual encounter, what factors do you rely on to take that position? Obviously, Justice Wilcox a few minutes ago talked about some things on the other side. What are the factors that you think lead to the conclusion that this is a consensual encounter?
Well, it's basically, I think you start with the idea that an encounter between a police officer and an individual is a consensual encounter unless there's a seizure. And for there to be a seizure, there has to be some police conduct to make it a seizure. Here, I don't think there was any police conduct that would do that. The traffic stop was over. The person said they could leave. The only thing that happened after that point was the police officer asking the questions. Now, the trial court and the defendants make something of several factors here. One was the tone of voice, the nature of the questions, how they were, the manner in which they were asked. I could describe that and characterize it. The court has the videotape, which if it hasn't seen already, will obviously have the chance to see, and that's, I think, the best way to view how those questions were asked. I think they were asked basically in a conversational tone. There wasn't much difference from the way the officer spoke to Mr. Williams when asking the questions from earlier when they were very friendly and cooperative in disposing the traffic matter. As far as some of these other factors, such as the presence of a second police officer, that officer was there for the traffic stop and just continued there. And some of the cases we have cited from other jurisdictions point out that when other officers are present, just standing by passively, they're not going to count that as, indicating a seizure, that a person would not feel free to leave just as an officer standing by passively. Where the courts have found role of extra officers as indicating a seizure have been cases where the office, those extra officers usually participated or got involved in asking the driver for consent or questions. There's somewhere, remember one case, was cited originally in one of the Mr. Williams or Mr. Matthews' brief. The officer made the initial officer asked the driver if he had any guns or drugs or whatever, and for consent, and the driver said no. Then the second officer immediately comes up, asks the same questions, and the court said, well, you know, you're kind of pushing it there when you get put the extra pressure from extra officers. But in a situation like this, where the officer is there, second officer is there clearly for backup, just for safety purposes, and he's just standing there. He's not participating in any way other than just make sure that the passenger in the car can't do anything to create some safety problem. I don't think that's an indication of that the person, that Mr. Williams, couldn't leave. The flashing emergency lights are another one that the Court of Appeals mentioned. Now, there was no mention of that in the suppression hearing. Neither defendant raised any issue about that. Mr. Williams testified. He never mentioned the flash of emergency lights as something indicating he couldn't leave when the traffic stop was over. Now, of course, the emergency lights are an indication of a show of authority to stop the car initially. But when the traffic stop is over, in the darkness, the fact that the flashing lights continue while everyone is still outside the cars, I don't think is an indication the person is not free to leave, and I don't think they'd get that message. He obviously was leaving, even though there was a second officer there. There were the flashing lights, and it was 2:30 in the morning on an interstate highway. He was on his way to the car.
Did he have his driver's license back at the time that these questions were being asked?
Yes, before he even started to his car. Well, there's the original traffic stop. The officer goes up to the car, asks some initial questions, then goes back to his squad car, phones and calls in for some information, and asks for backup. Then, when the second officer arrives, the two officers approach the car. Mr. Officer Featherston goes to the driver's side. The backup officer stands by the passenger. Officer Featherston then asks Mr. Williams to get out of the car, when he come back and stand between Williams' car and Featherston's car. They're standing there in front of the squad car. At that point is when the Featherston gives him the warning ticket, points out in the rental agreement that he's not supposed to be driving, and then Mr. Williams says, I didn't know about that. And the officer says, well, okay, here's your rental agreement back. He gives him back the driver's license and the rental agreement. Says if you sign the warning ticket, then we can get you on your way. And Williams signs the warning ticket. Featherston asks if he has any questions, and Williams says no. He's aware of how it works with the stops. The officer then shakes his hand, says okay, you can be on your way, and that's when Mr. Williams says okay, have a good day, and then turns and starts walking to his car. So everything he needed to leave had been returned to him. The ticket had been disposed of, or the reason for the stop had been disposed of when he'd given the warning ticket, and he was on the way to his car.
Did the officers have any right to search prior to the, or during the course of the seizure associated with the traffic violation?
No. It was just the traffic stop. At least the officer said he didn't believe he had any reasonable suspicion to do a frisk. In fact, at some point, I think someone was asked why he didn't frisk Mr. Wayne's in the beginning, and he said, well, he had no reason to. He didn't have a basis for doing it.
What about a consent search in that context? That's no good either?
At what point, no?
During the traffic stop itself.
Well, that's been discussed in the Gallwrap case, and they said that's okay to ask for consent during the traffic stop. And which kind of brings up an analytical approach for looking at this case. It's been the state's theory, and I think at least that of Mr. Matthews, that the original traffic stop was over. Mr. Williams was free to leave. If he was seized during the consent, that was a second seizure. And so we'd have to look at that, whether there's a basis for that, and that's what we've been arguing about, whether it was consent or a seizure. Under that analysis, if it's a second seizure, that's what we have conceded in the Court of Appeals, that if that was a seizure, as the officer said, there's no reasonable suspicion to support it, then it would be invalid and the consent would be invalid and the evidence suppressed. The other way of looking at it, which some courts do, is say, well, this is all just continues on from the traffic stop. It's one seizure. And if that's the case, if this unit is just one continuous seizure, then I think under Gallwrap and this court's decision in Griffith and the Seventh Circuit's decision in just January this year, where they said you can ask for consent during a traffic stop, then I think it's valid, even if it comes at the end. Griffith pointed out that even if it comes after the traffic stop is disposed of, it's all part of the same stop, it's still legitimate under that original stop.
State's not asking that officers be required to tell somebody you're free to go and you don't have to answer my questions.
No, the United States Supreme Court's already said you don't have to tell them.
That's right.
Robinette case.
You think it's good practice?
I think, as an appellate attorney, I think it's good practice. I think it makes it easier to argue that the person knew he was free to leave because the officers told him he was free to leave. There are cases that have found that there was no seizure even when the officer did not advise him he couldn't leave. As I said, from a selfish point of view, I think it makes it easier for me.
Well, in Bostick, there was a notice that he didn't have to answer questions.
That's what the police did, as a matter of fact, but that I don't think the court held that was required.
No, but it was a factor to be considered.
Correct, yeah.
Same thing in Mendenhall.
Right, it's a factor. And here we have that factor on our behalf, the officer. As soon as you sign the warning ticket, you can be on your way. And then after he gave the documents back and disposed of them, he said, okay, now you can be on your way, and he shakes hands. But
in Bostick and Mendenhall, they were told they didn't have to cooperate, didn't have to answer questions.
Well, in Bostick especially, there the court focused not so much on the freedom to leave because they said the person's not leaving. They're on the bus. They want to stay on the bus, so it's not a question of leaving. They said in that context, then best advise them that, it's good to advise them that they don't have to give consent. Here it was the question of leaving. So I think it's enough when the officer says, you can be on your way. I don't think he additionally has to tell them that he doesn't have to give consent. In fact, the Strickler case, so many cases here, I hope I keep them straight. The Strickler case is one where the officer turned to leave, didn't tell him, he definitely did not tell him the person could leave. The court said that turning away was almost the same message. And I think it's that case that said that, telling him he doesn't have to give consent is as good as telling him he's free to leave. I mean, so the emphasis is on telling the person they're free to leave. And there's some of these cases which you pointed out when I've tried to distinguish cases cited by the defendants. I just point out that they didn't tell them they're free to leave. In some of those cases, specifically say, I think Hansen is one, where they found that there was a seizure, but the court said, had he told the person he was free to leave, that would have been enough to support the trial court's finding that it was a consensual encounter. So it is an inner factor, and it is present here. He was advised he could leave.
Counsel, what rule of law are we to get out of this case? If it's a totality of circumstances, and I note that the trial court here went through a litany of circumstances and concluded that my experience, my training, and common sense tells me that the situation created was unfair to the average citizen. The search was wrong. The Court of Appeals goes through a litany of stuff and says, okay, it was, they just started the questioning after, without missing a beat, it was almost a seamless transition. Forms of the questions indicate not free to not answer. The tone was abrupt. The volume was increased. In fewer than 15 seconds, almost six questions were asked and then went into other things. And so the Court of Appeals also thought that this didn't meet the test. I mean, there's seven of us. What if six of us or five of us or four of us say, it did meet the totality of circumstances test? What rule of law is it that you're looking for here, other than some people may respond differently on this court to flashing sirens at 2:30 in the morning? What is it?
Well, it's hard to, as you say, it's hard to say to state a rule of law in a totality of circumstances case. However, as the Supreme Court has pointed out a couple times, one of the most recently in this Arvizu case that was decided this year, in the case of reasonable suspicion, which is also a totality of circumstances test, it's significant that that review is de novo, just like this would be on it, because, you know, as you piece cases together, you could develop, as they call it, a mosaic of various cases that said two decisions when viewed together may usefully add to the body of law on the subject. What it gets at here is, I think it's significant, if this court reverses the lower courts, says this was not a seizure, what the officer did was okay, it was a consensual encounter, that gives some guidance as to the proper way to go about seeking consent. The police officer knows that if he follows this pattern, it's probably going to be okay. Now, there may be additional factors that crop up in other cases, but at least under this pattern, this will provide precedent that this is probably okay. I think a problem we have with the Court of Appeals decision as written is that it mentions a lot of factors, so we've considered these factors, and we find there was a seizure. And I know people have told me that they get questions from police officers, and they don't know how to advise them now how to do it correctly.
What factor is it that they missed that weighs heavily in the totality of circumstances that would cause a different result to be reached?
Well, I think the court gave too much weight to, I think support for this as far as many of the other cases I've cited, when you look at how the other cases weigh the various factors. I think the Court of Appeals gave too much weight to the time and place of this, to the fact the emergency lights were on, and to the presence of a second officer who was just standing by passing. I also think, and again, this is where the court has the advantage in this case of being able to view for itself the tape and the questioning. I don't agree with their characterization of the questioning. I don't think it was commanding. I think the officer was pretty much a conversational tone. He didn't demand an answer. He just raised a question. And so by giving too much weight to these other factors, which certainly may have been a reason to make the person feel he couldn't leave during a traffic stop, when they get the message that the stop is over and they're told that they're free to leave and they start leaving, and then the only thing that happens after that is the questions, which, again, I don't think are that bad, but I don't think conclude that that's a seizure. At least in some of the cases where the state has lost some other jurisdictions, the courts have made the point, as I said, well, had the officer said he was free to leave, that would have switched the balance here. I mean, as it stands now, as a practical matter, I think the only factor in this case that could be changed in the future has to do with the questions. I mean, the officer has no control over the time and place to stop. Safety factors they're still going to have to flashing lights on to warn other traffic and protect themselves. They're going to have other officers for backup, especially when there's more than one person. I mean, there's two officers here and two people. So the only factor left that you could possibly alter somewhat is the question somehow. But I don't see how there could be even much play in that. I mean, there's just not that much that can be done.
Well, then what's the rule of law? That if the officer says you're free to leave and within 15 seconds asks questions, that's voluntary. Is that the rule of law?
Well, again, as I said, it's hard to say it's a rule of law. I mean, maybe the other situation where, you know, as they said in Robinette, you don't have to say the person, you don't have to tell the person free to leave. So there are going to be others where the officer doesn't say that, and the factors will show that the person was free to leave.
Ordinarily, the court is giving guidance to trial courts and the Court of Appeal, right?
Right.
As I heard you answer this question, you want guidance for police officers who are educated and read the Fourth Amendment cases that we take.
Right.
Okay. And so they would like to know how to deal with it, because they want to do it right. They want to preserve the evidence, and they prefer not to have a suppression.
Correct.
All right. So we are now giving guidance to the police officers. Isn't the simplest guidance to give them, even though not required by the U.S. Supreme Court, is to tell the person, you are free to leave, I have some questions, and you need not answer them. That's ironclad, right?
I think that if the officer tells them that, that, again, as an appellate attorney speaking selfishly, I think that, that I don't know how a defendant would then say, I didn't know I couldn't leave, I didn't know I couldn't answer.
Oh, you got a rule that all officers can easily follow.
Yes.
That a rule that protects people from a government intrusion. On the other hand, you got a rule that was gonna, that will say to people, after they're told that you don't have to answer, that they can say, okay, I prefer not to answer. And then these people walk off, a ride off, into the sunrise with a loaded weapon, right?
Yes.
Drugs.
Yes.
And money.
Yes.
That's not good.
It's not good, but if they, if there's no basis, if there's no probable cause or reasonable suspicion, and they deny consent, that's what we have to live with. There's
under our system of government.
Yes.
But you don't want to take the chance of telling them that. You prefer that they be ignorant of that.
Well, I didn't say. Under Ohio versus Robinette, that court has already said you don't have to tell them.
Right, consent. I agree.
And as a matter of practice,
whether I agree with it or not, that's the rule.
Yeah, and I guess, yeah, and if the police officer wants to pretty much guarantee that it's going to be admissible, if he tells them that, yeah. But even doing that, there may be cases where the defendant says, yeah, he told me that, but I'm surrounded by six police officers who are blocking my path.
Guns. Yes.
Yes. So, I mean, there may be some case where the words themselves won't be sufficient.
Sure, that there's pressure. You don't believe what the officer told you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Justice Sykes.
If a consent search in the context of a traffic stop is constitutionally permissible, then why go through this whole exercise of ending the stop and taking two steps toward the squad car and coming back and asking questions either with or without the warnings that are being discussed?
Well,
is it because the
when you got the consent, there's at least two questions: whether it was okay, whether it was a seizure or not, and whether it was okay to ask it during the seizure. There's also this another question about, was it a related but separate question: was it voluntary? And I think there may be more problems for the state to establish voluntariness if the police officer there is still holding the guy's driver's license and hasn't disposed of the traffic ticket, and then trying to get voluntary consent. I mean, the other side is going to say, well, I gave it because I didn't give it. He's going to give me a ticket, or, I didn't know. I couldn't go anywhere.
So two things, harder to establish voluntariness of the consent.
Yes.
And harder to establish that the questions that led to the consent search were within the scope of the original stop.
Well, under GALRAP, as long as you don't extend the time too far, it's okay to ask it, even if it's the timing more than the substance of the question. And you also get then the question that you have more of a concern about how many questions get asked. If it's consensual, there's no particular reason that there has to be, the time is a factor. If it's during the stop and the questions take too long, then you get the problem of, it was okay to ask if it was one question maybe, but if you asked six, that takes too much time, you've extended it too long. You avoid some of those problems if it's done afterwards when the person's free to leave.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. I now have two attorneys sharing a half hour. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Tell me your name.
My name is Thomas Kenothi. I'm from La Crosse. I represent Lawrence Williams in this case. May it please the court, State of Wisconsin. I've got a canned speech here to make, but I'm going to skip it and get right to addressing the points made by Mr. Kleinmeier. I'll start, I think, with Justice Sykes' comment about, is it okay to ask these questions during the traffic stop? I mean, what's the big deal if we just wait and do it after the traffic stop? The difference is, if the questions are asked during the traffic stop, they are part of a detention or a seizure, but they have to relate to the purpose of the stop. Questions asked during a valid Fourth Amendment stop or seizure have to relate to the purpose of the stop. That was spelled out by this court in Griffith. In Griffith, we had a detainer, a stop, and there was no question that the question of the backseat passenger was made during the stop. The question then was, well, how do we analyze this? And this court chose to analyze it by asking whether or not this incremental intrusion upon this individual's rights was reasonable. And what they did was, or what this court did was, weighed the private interest against the public interest. And on the private, or on the public side, they said that the questions must relate to the purpose of the stop or they're unreasonable. That's just a natural flow from the United States Supreme Court's decisions in Royer, in Bostick, and Rodriguez. They all say that the questions, when you're talking about a detainer, to determine whether or not it's reasonable, you have to look at two dimensions: scope of the questions and time of the questions. Does it prolong it unnecessarily time-wise, and does it invade upon the person's rights as a matter of scope? And the court, I think it was in Royer, talked about, well, if a person's driving through Utah and they're stopped for a speeding violation, is it okay to ask that person if they practice polygamy? Of course not. It only takes a second to answer that question or ask that question, but it's not okay. It's as much as a violation of the Fourth Amendment as prolonging a stop for a half hour to search somebody's person or belongings. So I think that might answer your question, Justice Sykes. As far as whether or not my client, Mr. Williams, had a choice out there on the interstate that night, I don't think anybody who has any common sense would probably suggest that after viewing the tape that he really had a choice. And I think the reason this badger stop terminology is important is because, or relevant at least, is because this officer, Featherston, wasn't just your normal state patrol officer. He was an instructor at the State Patrol Academy teaching these drug interdictions. This was all an act that night. He said it that he wasn't going to be done with this stop until this guy gave up a seizure.
Counsel, if it's an objective test, what difference does that make?
I think it goes to the way he played out this stop with this individual, Mr. Williams. I think if you watch the tape, he's real jovial. He's joking with Mr. Williams, shaking hands. He's giving a warning instead of a ticket. And then Mr. Williams doesn't turn and walk away. He turns and takes 1.5 steps. Mr. Featherston, or Officer Featherston, goes like this. He turns this much and starts drilling them with 6 or 8 questions, depending how you look at it. He has 6 questions. He has 2 of them twice. It's boom, 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 boom in 15 seconds. Excuse me?
That's what you just stated, what I had suspected, that this whole thing was a ploy by the officer designed to put the defendant at ease and let his guard down. And it probably is quite effective. I mean, all of a sudden this guy's thinking that this officer is a nice guy and he's only got his best interests at stake, etc. But assuming that, and I am assuming now, that's the purpose, to have him let his guard down. What's wrong with that if, in fact, it leaves the defendant, the future defendant, at ease? And therefore, doesn't that add to the state's case that he would feel free to leave?
Justice Pavlich, I think the difference between this situation no-knock-announce cases. There's a big difference. In the no-knock or the pizza ruse cases, the person is in a house. They're not detained. They don't have, circumstances aren't that they would feel compelled to answer. Here, you have an individual out on the side of the roadway. This is akin, I think, to a Terry stop, where he's not going to go anywhere until the officer lets or allows the person to go. I think the police officer's motivation does not support the state's case. He doesn't feel more likely to go. It's just, I think, says he was doing a better job of coercing this defendant. As far as it being effective, we don't have any empirical studies here in the state of Wisconsin. However, there was a case that was decided and released Monday out of New Jersey. It was the Cardi case. Got a lot of play in national media. It showed that 95% of people ask for consent, give consent to search their cars during a traffic stop, and only 20% show up with any criminal or any type of violation. So it's not necessarily very effective. Our record doesn't have that, I understand. I would like to talk about...
Is your objection to the fact that the officer tricked him?
My objection is that a reasonable person under these circumstances would have felt compelled to answer those questions, and therefore this is a seizure for Fourth Amendment purposes. Because it's a seizure, the police officer must be able to articulate reasonable and individualized suspicions of criminal activity. Officer Featherston didn't have those. The state concedes if this is a seizure, that it's an invalid seizure. I would like to just touch on Gulrap. I know this court spoke about Gulrap in the Griffith decision. I think there's a couple of reasons why Gulrap should not be followed here. For one, it's certainly not controlling. It's a court of appeals case. It also dealt with a question different than this case does. It involved a detainer. And the specific question in Gulrap was the detainer or the seizure unnecessarily or unreasonably prolonged by asking the question? There was only one question in Gulrap: do you have any drugs on you? I think Gulrap held that asking questions about or during a traffic stop about drugs did not unreasonably extend the valid stop because, and then it cited Robinette for the proposition that you look at how long it prolonged it, and it was only a few seconds in that case. And the problem with Gulrap is that's not what Robinette said. That's an overbroad interpretation of Robinette. Robinette cited Bostick and Royer for the proposition that you have to look when determining whether a detainer is reasonable or not, you have to look at the scope and the time. And Gulrap just hit on the time, took a few extra seconds. It didn't explain this whole scope dimension to Fourth Amendment analysis of detainers or seizures. Gulrap also decided only that consent, or I'm sorry, it cites to Robinette, and Robinette decided only that consent given to search a vehicle after the conclusion of a stop is not per se involuntary when the officer failed to inform. Robinette did not address the issue of whether we had a seizure like this case presents to this court.
So what is the rule you are asking us for, counsel?
The rule I'm asking is that this court set forth which analysis is to be used in these types of cases. Do you look at them as two separate stops, and then you look at the totality of the circumstances with respect to each stop? Do we look at it as one detainer, and we ask whether or not it's prolonged? You know, we have a 15-and-a-half-minute stop followed by a 15-second stop here. Should we look at it as one and then do the analysis like Griffith, where the question is this an incremental intrusion? And then we go through the analysis of balancing the private against the public interest. Or a third way you could look at it is just weighing the private versus public interest. I would like this court to decide which analysis is going to be used in the state of Wisconsin. And then I think it would be a good thing for this court to set out the factors to be looked at. And I've got a list of 13 factors, if the court would like to hear them. That.
So which is the analysis you prefer, the three that you...
All right, I will do that.
Pardon me?
I'm sorry.
Which of these three do you prefer? Two separate stops, one stop, or waive public and private interests?
Certainly this case has zeroed in on the two-stop analysis. That's the way it was looked at up through the Court of Appeals. I think either method favors our position. In other words, I think if you look at it as two separate stops, the totality of the circumstances favor the respondent's position that this was an unreasonable detainer. Any reasonable person would have thought that they could not just walk away from this officer. If you look at it as a prolonged detainer, one detainer, then you have the problem that the questions asked by Officer Featherston have no relationship to the purpose of the stop, and it's an unreasonable prolonging of one stop. But either...
If you had been lecturing law enforcement officers, how would you have advised them do something different so that the search was acceptable?
I would lecture and tell the police officers that it is to their benefit to notify the defendants in these situations that they don't have to answer the questions that are posed to them and they don't have to consent. That actually was done in Strickler, which is a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case. The officer told the defendant. Courts have said there's a mystery about this Fourth Amendment jurisprudence. I think the reason that is because you can find a case that says just about anything from some jurisdiction. They all, however, come back to the Mendenhall free-to-leave test. You're all looking at these different factors. Some courts only look at a few factors, but I've got a list of 13 factors, and 12 of them are present in our case. It's hard for me to believe that Mr. Williams or any other reasonable person out there that evening would have felt free to just say, see you later, I'm leaving. The state would have us believe that Mr. Williams just came back and decided to consent to a nice conversation with this officer. It's not what happened.
Where did you get the factors from, counsel?
From looking at about 100 different cases.
Did you pick the ones that fit your case?
No, I think the only one that I found that didn't fit my case was a touching by the police officer.
Touching?
A touching. And as far as this, the state has put this great argument together about you shouldn't consider some of these factors because they go to the safety of the officer and perhaps even the people in the car out there in the evening. You know, it might be true. It does go, the flashing lights and the positioning of the parties, it does go to the safety of gentlemen out there that night. But that doesn't negate the fact that it impacted or impacts what a person, a reasonable person, would think. It's still a show of authority. It's no different than a gun or a badge. Those are for safety. Yet, we consider those. Those are the greatest show of authority there is.
Well, it sounds to me, counsel, like you are asking for a rule of law that you'll teach your police students that when confronted with a situation such as this and they have no evidence or no reasonable suspicion, that they must, before searching the car, advise the defendant that they have a right not to answer any of the questions and they have a right to refuse to consent to a search. That sounds like the rule of law you're asking.
I'm not asking for a per se rule. I'm asking for, just like all other jurisdictions use, a totality of the circumstances, but I think that factor is very important. I think there's really two or three really important factors. One is, did the officer notify the defendant that they had a right not to answer? And secondly, how closely did the questions follow the initial detainment? Most citizens aren't going to even know that they were free to go, and now they're entering into something known as a consensual encounter. It's so seamless that there's really no difference. Most reasonable people would never, ever realize they've gone from a traffic stop where they have to answer all the questions of the officer to something known as a consensual encounter. I think it's just a fiction. It allows police to make standardless stops and seizures. I don't think the people of Wisconsin deserve that.
So you are, just to clarify, you are or you are not suggesting that in the absence of those warnings, the consent is bad as a rule of law?
It could. I'm not asking for a per se rule that the officer has to tell the driver or the defendant that they're free to go. All I'm saying is that is a very important factor in a totality of circumstances analysis.
I read a lot of factors in your brief. Are all 13 of your factors that seemingly have in front of you covered in your brief?
I think so.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, representing Antoine Matthews.
Good morning. My name is Pete Thompson. I'm attorney for Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Counsel, wait until you get to the podium because your words are being recorded.
Thank you. I just want to supplement the remarks of counsel. I think as we sit here and as we try to analyze these cases, we're all trained as attorneys, and we're all, some of us are judges, and we're grappling with some concepts such as how to approach this case, and should it be a two-part analysis? And by the way, that is my approach. Should be a continued attention, or should we have a balancing approach? And we may overlook and lose sight of the fact that you had a young man from out of town on a stretch of interstate who stopped in the middle of the night. And ultimately, we're going to determine what the reasonable man understands and imputed to Mr. Williams. What is the scope of police procedure? What are the proper police protocols in a search? That's something that's argued constantly in the courts, and that's something that Williams, if he had the presence of mind to try to think about that, would have to have been grappling with at the time his license and papers were handed back, and they shook his hand, and he turned to leave. Now, he was immediately re-engaged, and the sequence of the questions that took place, in effect, retracted the explicit statement that he was free to leave, and anybody who was free to leave has the authority to give you permission to leave also has the permission to retract that. The temporal sequence here leads us to believe that it could only be deemed to be a retraction, a continuation. Oops, I forgot. And by the way, and you're still here. Now, could Williams have said, I don't want to answer your questions? Yes, he could have. If you haven't looked at the tape, you might consider how much time he would have had to formulate that answer. There probably isn't a second or two in that sequence of questions to fit to then. But I think the more common reaction by a layperson would have been, can I leave or not? And if I refuse to answer questions, and if I tell the officer I don't want to ask the questions, what then? I'm standing there in the middle of the road or in the middle of the safety lane, still facing this officer who's clothed with all the indicia of authority and asking me question after question. Do I have the presence of mind to turn around, turn my back to him, go around to the passenger or the driver's door, get in the car, start the car, and then pull out in a busy lane with flashing lights? I think it would be a rare individual who would have that presence of mind on the statistics that we've heard here, and there are some cited indicate it's a rare individual whoever declines to answer questions by a police officer. What we have here is a script, but since it's an objective test, we can, regardless of why it was scripted, we can look at the results, and the results here I think overwhelmingly indicate that a reasonable person would have a hard time considering seriously that he could have left. It doesn't matter what the purpose was, what the plan was, what the script was. Wren may or may not extend in this situation, may or may not extend beyond the point where the papers were returned. But since it is an objective test, I think we should just focus solely on the impact on the reasonable man. And on the tape, the questions come in quick sequence. It's an effective retraction of the permission, the exercise of power, the grace to let him go down the highway, and in effect a reemphasis of that authority. I don't think a reasonable man would feel in any way that he had the real ability to do that. Now, the lights, I touch on the lights. There are a number of factors here that were not fully developed at trial. However, the Court of Appeals did review the tape and did make some findings as to the lights. There are layers of ambiguity here. When you're sitting there out on the highway and you want to pull out, the question is, can I pull out? And what's the purpose of these lights? And do these lights detain me? I footnote a couple of statutes which provide, as any driver would understand, that when there are flashing lights, you have to pull over and you are controlled by those lights. This is an inherently ambiguous situation. This situation is not in any way, however, seriously damaging to the ability of the state to effect traffic stops or to protect the safety of officers and detained persons, because there are any number of simple remedies to deal, for instance, with the lights. An officer could say, I'm going to leave the lights on for safety while you pull out, and please pull out 100 yards or whatever. Or he could say, I'm going to turn the lights off now. Or he could do presumably any number of things to make clear that the lights should have no effect on the understanding of the detainee. Now, I agree that I believe that the state has shown nothing to support at least its implicit proposition in its briefs in this court that that the court should consider safety issues, traffic hazard issues, as well as assault hazard issues in some way so as to diminish the impact of objective factors on a detainee. There's simply nothing there. So we still are left with the impact of these objective matters upon the detainee. I can't come up with a rule for you. I've thought about this, and I would love to have a rule, and I'm sure everyone would love to have a rule. What I see in this case is a situation where the state has so artfully created an impression that you really have no option but to stay there and answer questions, that at that point there is some burden upon the state to clarify that there really is an option. If there's such an overwhelming show of authority, if there's a retraction, a clear retraction of authority to leave, i.e. you have to stay, if there are serial questions, one after the other, with little time to answer, little time to even gather your thoughts, if there are lights flashing, if you're not sure if you can leave, if you would have to leave by turning your back on a questioning officer, if you'd have to get in a car with two officers there, one standing right next to your car, and pull out under what circumstances you don't know. He could pull it right out into the lane, or he could go forward and possibly hit the officer by the stand. There's all these factors. When it reaches this level, there is some burden on the state to take some simple steps to clarify that, in fact, there is the option to either not answer questions or to leave. That's the closest I can come to suggesting a rule.
Thompson. Mr. Kleinmeier?
I guess I'd like to start out just by repeating what I said beginning earlier. Just the fact that police officers answer questions, and just because, as the Supreme Court has acknowledged in the Delgado case, citizens are inclined to answer police questions, doesn't make it a seizure. You need something in addition to just the fact that people are willing to answer questions. The counsel for Mr. Williams said that this whole test is just a fiction. Well, he agrees with LaFave. LaFave says it's a fiction. And actually, much of the Williams' brief from pages 9 to 11 is very similar to pages 95 to 101 of Volume 4 of LaFave. And thing is, LaFave also says the Mendenhall standard should not be given such a literal reading as to produce such a result as finding that virtually all police encounters would be deemed seizures. And LaFave suggests a test and to accommodate, go along with Mendenhall, and on page 101, it says, under this approach, an officer is not made a seizure if, for example, he interrogated in a conversational manner, did not order the defendant to do something or demanded to do something. In this case, I think you had this situation where the questions came in a conversational manner, and he didn't demand that Mr. Williams do anything. As far as 95% of the people answering police questions or giving consent, I think that just goes along with, again, what this court and Delgado has already recognized. As a court, police people just respond. If a police officer walks up to someone in the street and they answer questions, that's not a seizure. I mean, just asking the questions, and I don't think it is anymore in this case either.
Counsel, I have a little bit of concern with what kind of door we might be opening up if we go along with you, if we say that this was okay. Because then my mind starts saying, well, okay, what happens then if during the course of this rapid-fire questioning the driver standing there starts to exhibit nervousness? Is that going to be enough to elevate this to a reasonable suspicion or to a probable cause? Or what if the guy refuses to answer at all and just gets into the car and drives away? I mean, a lot of people would say that that's indicative of guilt, although we can't say that.
Yeah, I don't think the state would be much of a position of saying a person's exercise of his right to silence is indicating a guilt. I think there's many cases we can't do that.
Hey, well, what about nervousness? I mean, I'd be awfully nervous at 2:30 in the morning.
This guy was nervous, and it wasn't enough for reasonable suspicion. The officer said he was hyperventilating. He was very nervous, but I didn't think that was enough for reasonable suspicion in the beginning. And I think there are cases saying nervousness alone is not enough to give reasonable suspicion. You'd have to have something to go with it.
But nighttime is. Isn't it? Was this highly trafficked? A lot of people out?
Well, there were cars. I don't know if I'd call it highly trafficked, but the videos take, you know, it's not like it's no cars going by and it's just some isolated country road. It's no evidence it's a high crime area, anything like that to go along with nervousness. So I think it's just getting nervous in response to the officer's questions. I'm not going to say it, you know. I've learned that in Fourth Amendment law, you never say never, because there's probably some case out there somewhere that's, you know, he finds
it. All you need is nervousness, and then in response to the question, do you have any drugs in there, he was nervous and his eyes started.
Yeah, I mean, I...
or dilated.
I don't see it, but then again, maybe some imagination later come up with it, but I don't think that would be enough. This is not an unusual situation. I mean, this, I've tried to demonstrate, I think, ad nauseum in my brief, going on and on about cases from other jurisdictions where police officers ask these questions, and the courts find it's a consensual encounter, especially where they've been advised he's free to leave, but that's not even required. So, I mean, I don't think that the state's not asking for something unusual here. It's just going along with what many other cases have said, because there weren't any special factors like multiple police, or, you know, extra police officers involved in the questioning, or persistent questioning after the person refuses to answer. If in your example, Justice Babbage, the person says, I don't want to answer, and the officer continues to question or continues to say, well, why don't you want to give me consent? And, you know, persists enough until he gets consent, then there's plenty of authority to support the defendants that would not be valid. But under the way it was conducted here, it satisfies the test from those other cases to say it was. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Attorney Kleinmeier. Thank you, Attorneys Thompson and Novy, and for our presentation.